people in our audience who have written to me about that, saying that that is what they are going to do. Consider it as an option that is available to you. We have such a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com to get access to the bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Absolutely right. We're going to make money on today's bonus show. You can use the coupon code indicted again. You can use the coupon code indicated. You could use the coupon code 24 starts now. Any code you want to use is fine, but joinpacman.com is the one place to use it. We'll see you on the bonus show, or otherwise, have a good weekend. We'll be back Monday. Republicans held more hearings yesterday. These are hearings where Republicans are determined to show that the FBI has been weaponized by the left against the right. The first problem that Republicans had yesterday in making that case is that they had testimony from Christopher Wray. Christopher Wray is the director of the FBI. Christopher Wray is a Republican. Christopher Wray votes for Republicans, and Christopher Wray was the selection of Republican President Donald Trump to lead the FBI. And yet, this did not stop Republicans from making fools of themselves with all sorts of allegations. You're defending Hunter Biden. You're covering for the Bidens. You're targeting Republicans, none of which are based in any actual evidence. We're going to look at these clips. And the point that I really want to hit home here for you is that this is our money being spent. We talk about, you know, I pay taxes. I don't like my money being used for so many weapons. I don't like my money being used for wars. Fine. I agree. I also don't like my money used for political theater that goes nowhere, uncovers nothing. And it is this sort of thing. Now, our friend, Congressman Ted Lieu, a Democrat, he had a brilliant line of questioning. We're going to get to the Republican questioning in a moment, which was cuckoo. Ted Lieu had a brilliant line of questioning here that speaks for itself. Let's take a listen.
Trump advisor Roger Stone was convicted in a federal court, correct?
That's my recollection.
Trump donor Elliot Brady was convicted in a federal court, correct?
Also my recollection.
The attorney general at the time for those two convictions was Bill Barr. Which president nominated Bill Barr for attorney general?
President Trump.
Okay. Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, was convicted on two separate occasions in a federal court, correct?
I believe that's correct.
The attorney general at the time for Cohen's second conviction was Matthew Whitaker. Which president appointed Matthew Whitaker as acting attorney general?
President Trump.
Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was convicted in a federal court, correct?
Yes.
Trump's former deputy campaign manager, Mr. Gates, was convicted in a federal court, correct?
That's my recollection.
Trump's campaign foreign policy advisor, George Papadopoulos, was convicted in a federal court, correct?
True.
Yes, I think he pled guilty, yes.
The attorney general at the time of those three cases was Jeff Sessions. Which president nominated Jeff Sessions for attorney general?
President Trump.
You were the FBI director for all of those cases at the time. Which president nominated you?
President Trump.
Okay. What these facts show is we don't have a two-tiered system of justice. We have one Department of Justice that goes after criminals regardless of party ideology. All of these folks were convicted under the administrations of three separate Republican attorneys general. It is not the fault of the FBI that Donald Trump surrounded himself with criminals.
This is, of course, such an obvious point that I can't believe needs to be made. But the vast majority of those who were convicted under the supposedly weaponized FBI were convicted under the leadership of a Republican FBI director and Republican attorneys general. Now, this was like the best moment of this entire hearing. We then get to some of the cartoonish moments. Here is Republican Congressman Chip Roy trying to make the case that the FBI has behaved in a tyrannical way. And FBI Director Wray struggling to get a word in edgewise, but managing to explain why that's not the case.
Your job is to protect the American people from a tyrannical FBI storming the home of an American family.
I could not disagree more with your description of the FBI as tyrannical.
And I don't believe it's tyrannical that FBI agents were a part of storming a father's home in suburban Philadelphia.
I'm the gentleman.
Mr. Chairman.
I wish they would let witnesses answer questions.
Time of the gentleman's expired. The witness may respond, and then we'll move to our next witness.
Sir,
our next,
respectfully,
member.
They did not storm his house. They came to his door. They knocked on his door and identified themselves. They asked him to exit. He did without incident.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Water temperatures off the coast of Florida are hitting some of the highest levels on record, creating a dire situation for the coral reefs.
We are in Phoenix, Arizona, talking about the scorching heat. Now, it's not just here in Arizona, but we're outside of Valley Wise Hospital, where they're talking about influx in patients suffering from all kinds of heat-related illnesses. We're talking about heat stroke. We're talking about heat exhaustion, as well as third-degree burns.
Temperature records are continuing to be smashed across Asia, Europe, and the United States, where over 100 million people remained under extreme heat advisories. We'll go to Texas to speak with Jeff Goodell, Rolling Stone reporter, author of the new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Then, towards a new era for human rights, we are highlights from panel I moderated in Venice, Italy this weekend, marking the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I spoke with Volker Türk, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Our position is very clear. I mean, cluster bombs should be prohibited.
We'll also hear from former Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström on her opposition to cluster bombs and Sweden's historic 2014 decision to recognize the state of Palestine.
We made it clear that we had no interest in making sort of Israel our enemy. We wanted to continue to work with Israel for a two-state solution, which is the decision and the position of the European Union.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Suffocating heat is gripping three continents as the summer's record-breaking temperatures continue to scorch large swaths of the United States, Asia, and Europe. 100 million U.S. residents remained under extreme heat advisories with dangerous conditions forecast this week in the South, the Southwest, and South Florida. In Arizona, an unrelenting heat wave is on track to break the previous record of 18 straight days of 110 degrees plus highs in Phoenix. That's Fahrenheit. Some of the most at risk include people who work outdoors, like construction workers, as well as unhoused people.
I've been here for 12 years, and I haven't seen nothing like it. It's hot. I fell asleep on some hot concrete, and my whole left side got third-degree burns on them. You know? So that's an eye-opener.
Europe could record its hottest day ever on the Italian islands of Sicily and Sardinia. Over the weekend, Italian authorities issued an extreme health risk in 16 cities, including Rome and Florence. Italians flocked to lakes and seasides in an attempt to cool down.
This is not normal. I don't remember such intense heat, especially at this time of year.
In northern Syria, displaced people describe the conditions at camps as akin to living in an oven. Children and elderly people are some of the most vulnerable, have scarce options for relief amidst 108-degree Fahrenheit heat. Meanwhile, China's just recorded its highest known temperature as the thermometer hit 126 degrees Fahrenheit, smashing the previous record by 3 degrees. In South Korea, at least 40 people have died after days of torrential downpours and flooding. 12 people were killed when 16 vehicles, including a bus, got trapped and inundated in a tunnel in Cheongju after a river levee collapsed. Grief-stricken locals called out the response of authorities to the disaster.
It feels like it could have happened to me. I feel like I've died. Authorities should have restricted access to the tunnel in advance. The response was insufficient.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, who also placed blame on authorities, called for better plans to deal with weather-related disasters, which are becoming commonplace due to the climate crisis. At least 100 people have died in India this month as the monsoon continues to wreak havoc with entire towns swamped while flooding washes away vehicles, bridges and roads. Delhi has received over 90% more rainfall than is considered normal during the monsoon. But the worst flooding has been experienced in the Himalayan region of Himachal Pradesh, where new construction to accommodate tourists has worsened landslides and flooding. This is a young girl whose former school was swept away.
I used to study in this school, and I felt really bad when the school building was washed away. The studies of children who are from far-off places are also suffering. I feel really sad that the children are hit by this loss. Our memories are also washed away with this school.
Here in the U.S., parts of the Northeast were pummeled with more rain over the weekend. In the Philadelphia suburbs of Bucks County, at least 5 people died after they were caught in flash flooding while in their car. At least 1,400 flights were canceled in the Northeast as of Sunday night. Meanwhile, thick smoke from hundreds of Canadian wildfires triggered air quality alerts across the Midwest, with Chicago, Minneapolis, and Milwaukee reporting unhealthy levels of air pollution. There are also warnings put out by the New York governor across the state. In the Canary Islands, Spanish authorities have evacuated more than 4,000 people from the island of La Palma as firefighters battle out-of-control wildfires. We'll have more on the global heat wave, extreme weather, and the climate crisis after headlines with Rolling Stone's reporter Jeff Goodell, author of The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Russia says it's terminating the Black Sea grain deal, which expires today. The deal's allowed for the safe export of food and fertilizer from Ukrainian ports and was seen as essential in combating global food insecurity. Today's announcement from Moscow came hours after the bridge connecting Crimea to Russia was shut down following early morning explosions, which killed 2 people and injured a child, according to Russian officials. Ukraine did not take explicit responsibility, though Ukrainian officials told several media outlets their forces carried out the attack. On the battlefield, Ukraine says it's gradually regaining control of more territory amidst reports of intense fighting along the Eastern Front. The U.S. says it will allow European countries to train Ukrainian fighters on U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets. Meanwhile, Russia's vowed to respond in kind if Ukraine deploys cluster bombs provided by the United States. This is Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu.
I want to mark that Russia has cluster bombs for all occasions. They are more effective than American and more widely varied.
Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. are not signatories to an international treaty banning the use of cluster bombs. We'll have more on cluster bombs later in the broadcast when I speak to U.N. Human Rights Chief Volker Turk and the former Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström. Both oppose the use of cluster bombs. President Vladimir Putin said he plans to go ahead with a trip to South Africa next month to attend the BRICS summit, despite a warrant for his arrest issued by the International Criminal Court. As a member of the ICC, South Africa would be obligated to arrest President Putin. UNICEF said Friday at least 289 migrant children drowned while trying to reach Europe so far this year, around twice as many as in the first 6 months of 2022. Over 11,000 children made the treacherous journey across the Mediterranean since the start of the year, according to the UN agency. Many of them were either unaccompanied or separated from family. A UNICEF official called for better protections for young asylum seekers, lamenting, quote, hundreds of girls and boys are drowning in the world's inaction. Libyan border guards have apprehended at least 80 exhausted and dehydrated migrants after they were rounded up by authorities in neighboring Tunisia and abandoned in the desert without food, water or shelter. The group is among hundreds of black African asylum seekers forcibly expelled from the city of Sfax in Tunisia's heavily militarized border with Libya. Refugees have faced abuse from authorities on both sides of the border with accounts of rape and sexual assault. On Sunday, Tunisia's government signed a strategic partnership with the European Union, pledging to crack down on migrants attempting to cross the Mediterranean to seek asylum in Europe. The agreement comes after the European Commission said it was considering an aid package for Tunisia worth over $1 billion. In Mexico, authorities apprehended over 500 asylum seekers this weekend in the state of Veracruz as the Mexican government intensifies its crackdown on migrants attempting to reach the U.S. border. More than 200 people, including children, were found in an abandoned trailer, many of them with symptoms of severe dehydration. At least six people were arrested for their role in transporting the hundreds of migrants who are mostly from Central America and Cuba. Stricter immigration policies in Mexico and the U.S. have forced asylum seekers to rely on smugglers and take on deadly routes to reach the United States. In Mexico, a journalist was shot dead Saturday in the state of Guerrero. Nelson Matus was the director of a local news outlet that reported worsening violence in the region. Matus was gunned down while he sat in his car in the parking lot of a store in the city of Acapulco. He had survived two other assassination attempts, including one in 2019. Iran's morality police have resumed patrolling the streets for the first time since the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in its custody in September. The morality police had largely been pulled back after Amini's death, which triggered massive nationwide protests. The move comes as Iranian authorities are escalating efforts to arrest women who are deemed in violation of the strict headscarf dress code. This is an Iranian student in Tehran.
Do you think the morality police can prevent women from not wearing a hijab? They cannot impose it like before. The number of people who do not obey is too high now. They cannot handle all of us. The last thing they can do is use violence and force against us.
Back in the United States, the Justice Department has opened an investigation into conditions at Atlanta-area jails following the death of another prisoner. Fulton County officials say 19-year-old Noni Batiste Kosoko was found unresponsive in her cell in the Atlanta City Detention Center last Tuesday. She was arrested on a misdemeanor warrant and held without bond. This follows the death last year of 35-year-old LaShawn Thompson, a black man who was being held in the Fulton County Jail psychiatric wing, where his family says he was eaten alive by insects and bedbugs in his cell. Assistant U.S. Attorney General Christian Clark says the probe will look into reports of deplorable conditions in Fulton County jails, lack of access to medical and mental health care, and the use of excessive force by staff. In Washington, the House of Representatives approved a record-shattering military budget of $886 billion for the coming fiscal year. Lawmakers approved the National Defense Authorization Act Friday by a vote of 219-210, with all but four Democrats opposed. The legislation appears doomed in the Democratic-controlled Senate after Republicans included amendments barring the Pentagon from reimbursing the expenses of personnel who travel out of state to obtain an abortion. This is Democratic Congressmember Greg Stanton of Arizona.
Today, nearly half of service women no longer have access to abortion care. Many live hundreds of miles from the nearest provider. Access to abortion should not depend on where someone lives or where they are stationed. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin rightly noted that the Dobbs decision would, quote, would interfere with the U.S. military's ability to recruit, retain, and maintain the readiness of a highly qualified force.
Other amendments added by Republicans bar the Pentagon from paying for gender-affirming medical care and hormone therapy for transgender people and ban the display of LGBTQIA pride flags at military bases. House Republicans refused to allow a vote on an amendment by Democratic Congressmembers Mark Pocan and Barbara Lee that would have slashed $100 billion from the military budget. And the Education Department said Friday it's canceling $39 billion in federal student debt for over 800,000 borrowers. $1,000. The plan will benefit those enrolled in income-driven repayment plans who would or should have qualified for relief after making monthly payments for 20 to 25 years, but did not because of oversight errors or shortcuts taken by loan servicers. The move, which has been in the works for at least the past year, comes 2 weeks after the Supreme Court struck down President Biden's student debt plan that would have eliminated $400 billion in student loans for some 40 million people. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, the heat will kill you first. Life and death on a scorched planet. We'll speak with Rolling Stone reporter Jeff Goodell about his new book.
Talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its scenes while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still.
The Sound of Silence, version by Disturbed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the suffocating heat gripping three continents as the summer's record-breaking temperatures continue to scorch large swaths of the United States, Europe, and Asia. China just saw its highest temperature in recorded history, topping 126 degrees Fahrenheit, smashing the previous record by 3 degrees. In northern Syria, displaced people describe the conditions at camps as akin to living in an oven, with children and the elderly facing few options for relief from 108-degree heat. Meanwhile, a third of people in the United States face excessive heat warnings or advisories this weekend, and Europe could record its hottest day ever this week. Italian authorities issued an extreme health risk in 16 cities as extreme heat dominated news reports worldwide.
As you can see, there are lots of tourists here in Italy, and some of them have collapsed in the last few days because of heat strokes. And that includes a British tourist who passed out in front of the Colosseum.
In Spain, thermal imaging resembles the sun as ground temperatures reach a blistering 140 degrees. Forest fires ripped through the Spanish island of La Palma, destroying homes and displacing hundreds. More than 1,000 miles away, the heat fans the flames in Croatia as well.
Water temperatures off the coast of Florida are hitting some of the highest levels on record, creating a dire situation for the coral reefs.
We are in Phoenix, Arizona, talking about the scorching heat. Now, it's not just here in Arizona, but we're outside of Valley Wise Hospital, where they're talking about an influx in patients suffering from all kinds of heat-related illnesses. We're talking about heat stroke. We're talking about heat exhaustion, as well as third-degree burnt.
The heat wave in Arizona is on track to break the previous record of 18 straight days of temperature surpassing 110 degrees Fahrenheit in Phoenix. Extreme heat now kills more people in the United States than any other extreme weather. Some of those most at risk include people who work outdoors as well as unhoused people. All this comes as a UN climate change report found the Earth could pass a dangerous temperature threshold in the next decade that could make climate disasters so extreme we will not be able to adapt unless urgent action is taken to reduce carbon emissions. For more, we're joined by longtime climate reporter Jeff Goodell, whose new book is just out, titled The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. He says he decided to write it after he walked for 10 blocks in Phoenix on a 115-degree Fahrenheit day and nearly passed out. making him realize he'd radically underestimated the dangers of extreme heat. Jeff Goodell has covered the climate crisis for over 20 years at Rolling Stone magazine. His guest essay in the New York Times is headlined "In Texas, Dead Fish and Red-Faced Desperation Are Signs of Things to Come." Jeff, welcome to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your new book. It's so important. You describe heat as a, quote, first-order threat that drives all other impacts of the climate crisis. Explain.
Well, you know, we're seeing these extreme heat events right now that you just described in your intro. It is drawing everyone's attention. But it's really important to grasp that as we burn fossil fuels and loading the atmosphere with CO2, we are, you know, the temperature, we're raising the temperature of the Earth, which is driving all of these other climate impacts that you have described and that we talk about when we talk about climate change, like sea level rise, like drought, like the wildfires that have been burning in Canada. Heat is the primary driver for this climate transformation that we're undergoing right now. It is this invisible force that is changing our world.
So talk about your experiences of the heat yourself from Phoenix to Texas. You write in your guest essay in the New York Times, in Texas, dead fish and red-faced desperation are signs of things to come. You can argue that Texas has done this to itself. The planet is getting hotter because of the burning of fossil fuels. This is a simple truth as clear as the moon in the night sky. No state has profited more from fossil fuels than Texas. Elaborate on this and don't speak in sound bites. Give us the whole meal.
Happily. So I moved to Texas 4 or 5 years ago, and I had lived in the Northeast, and it was really eye-opening moving here because this Texas really is the belly of the beast when it comes to both the energy transformation and the impacts of climate change. You know, this is a state that was, you know, built around fossil fuels. There's tremendous riches here as a result of our dependence upon fossil fuels. There's tremendous sort of economic and cultural inertia around oil and gas in this state, and you feel it everywhere you go here. But it's also the state where this transformation towards clean energy is happening very quickly. We had, you know, an extreme heat dome in the last couple of weeks here. There was a lot of concern about the grid going down, and the grid was okay. And largely because of 25% of the power that was going onto the grid during this extreme heat wave was from solar power, which performs very well in hot weather and is not only more reliable, but cheaper. And so we have these Texas, even Texas, is making this sort of transformation to a cleaner grid. The problem, of course, is it is not happening fast enough. And in Texas, you feel the changing of our climate in a very dramatic way. You know, there's the risks of sea level rise in Houston. There's a $30 billion Ike Dike that's beginning to be constructed to protect the petrochemical industry and the Houston shipping channel there. There's the heat waves that we've been suffering through in the last few weeks. There's, you know, water shortages. As part of my reporting, I was in the Rio Grande Valley, one of the most productive agricultural regions in the country. And, you know, the Rio Grande is drawing to a trickle there. And so, you know, there's these cascading consequences here where you're feeling the world changing beneath our feet. And yet the kind of politics and culture of this place are lagging far behind those changes.
Jeff, we've been talking about this for, well, since it was enacted, but as the deadly heat wave grips Texas, where you are, Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill eliminating mandatory water breaks for construction workers. I want to play a clip of Ana Gonzalez, the Texas AFL-CIO Deputy Director of Policy and Politics.
Texas is the deadliest state when it comes to construction. One worker dies every 3 days in our state. In fact, more workers die of heat-related illnesses in our state than any other state.
This is the mayor of the Petro Metro, that's Houston, Sylvester Turner, who warned the bill would have devastating consequences for people working outdoors.
If House Bill 2127 is allowed to stand and it prevents municipal units of government from saying to employers that under extreme weather conditions like heat, that you can't be mandated to provide water breaks, then can you imagine the number of workers who are out there in the heat, construction workers, people working on buildings, developments, you name it, that are going to face heat strokes. Some people will even possibly lose their lives because they're operating, working in very dangerous conditions. This bill is totally insensitive. It goes contrary to the health and well-being and welfare of workers who are out there doing working under conditions that many, if not most, folk would dare not work under.
I mean, that's the Houston Mayor Turner. Jeff, he was talking about the bill, hoping it wouldn't be passed. It has been passed and is going to soon go into effect.
Yeah, it is. And you know, Mayor Turner called it insensitive, and I would say that's a gross understatement. It's barbaric. I mean, I live here. I see what it's like working outside. I see these workers working, building, you know, the buildings that are going up here in Austin. Austin's a boom town, and there's construction everywhere. And, you know, it's hard for me during these heat waves to walk to my mailbox to check the mail. The idea that, you know, you're working on a rooftop or laying asphalt outside in this heat, and it's you're forbidden from taking water and shade breaks. I mean, it's just like back to, you know, kind of Sinclair Lewis's The Jungle. I mean, I don't know how to explain this other than to talk about, you know, a kind of, you know, there's a kind of racism to this. You know, the many of the workers here that are keeping the state going are Mexican. They're coming across the border. They're work incredibly hard. You know, it's just, you know, a kind of politics that's rising here in Texas that I have no kind of good moral explanation for how this can be justified in any way. And in my book, I write about the death of an agricultural worker named Sebastian Perez, not in Texas, but in Oregon, who died in the fields because he was afraid that if he took a water break and a shade break, he would lose his job. And so this kind of this law that the governor, this legislation that the governor has signed, is going to directly result in the deaths of many Texans.
In your new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet, Jeff Goodell, you write about what happens to our bodies as the heat rises above 107 degrees Fahrenheit. You say as the heat rises, the proteins unfold and the bonds that keep the structures together break. At the most fundamental level, your body unravels. Your insides melt and disintegrate. You're hemorrhaging everywhere. Take it from there, Jeff.
Well, that's sort of the end. To begin, you know, our bodies are finely tuned machines that work in a very narrow temperature range. All of us understand that intuitively. If you have a temperature of 100 degrees, you know something's going on in your body. If you have a temperature of 101 or 102, you're calling the doctor. If you have a temperature of 105, you're going to the hospital. We all know this in our lives. But we don't understand the risks of that, you know, in an outdoor environment and in these kinds of extreme heat events. What happens when your body gets hot is we only have one mechanism to cool down, and that is sweat, as we all know. When it gets hot, our heart starts pumping faster, and it's pushing the blood away from our internal organs and away from our brains, which is one of the reasons why you get kind of dizzy or hallucinogenic or lightheaded when you're suffering from extreme heat. And it, as it pushes the blood away from the internal organs towards our skin to cool off through sweating, it puts enormous strain on a heart. And so a lot of people who are the most vulnerable to heat are people who have heart conditions, circulatory issues, taking medications that are related to that. And your body is in this sort of desperate attempt to dissipate this heat. And when you're an outdoor worker, when you are in an environment that your body just can't sweat enough, or either because you're not drinking enough water and you loses the ability to sweat, or you just simply can't kind of dump enough heat out of your body to keep your internal body temperature from rising above 101, 102, 103, 104, 105, then the things start happening that you described, which is you're literally the membranes of your cells begin to melt. The proteins that control the functions of those cellular structures begin to unfold, and your body kind of literally melts from the inside. And it's a horrible way to go, and it's something, you know, most people who die of heat stroke don't get that far. It's usually a heart attack or something like that that is the cause of death. But it's also one reason why heat mortality is dramatically underestimated in our accounting of it, because unlike a knife or a gunshot, there is no kind of heat wound when someone dies from extreme heat. So a lot of people die of heart attacks or other circulatory problems, and they're never diagnosed as heat deaths. And so these sort of mortality numbers that you were citing in the opening and that I cite in my book are widely understood to be grossly underestimated.
Your New York Times op-ed, if there's one thing we should understand about the risks of extreme heat, it's this. All living things, from humans to hummingbirds, share one simple fate. If the temperature they're used to, what scientists sometimes call their Goldilocks zone, rises too far, too fast, they die. Talk about the Goldilocks zone, and also talk about why you don't like the term global warming, Jeff.
Yeah, the Goldilocks zone is a phrase that scientists use when they're who are looking for life on other planets. What they're looking for is planets that are not too cold, so that what they're looking for is liquid water. And if the planets are too cold, the water is ice. If it's too hot, the water is vaporized and it's gone. So they're looking for this sort of medium temperature planets, this what they call the Goldilocks zone. And I use it in my book because all life on our planet has evolved under this relatively stable climate. Just as we are, able to maintain our steady temperature in this sort of given climate zone that we've evolved into, so is it true with pine trees and lizards and polar bears and sharks in the ocean. And all living things have this sort of thermal range that we can deal with. And one of the profound things that's happening as we heat up our planet is we're moving out of that Goldilocks zone, not just for us as humans, but for all living creatures. And so that has profound implications in the sort of distribution of life on our planet. It means that people are going to move, animals are going to move, plants are going to move. They need to migrate to cooler places. And if they can't migrate to cooler places, they die. And it's a very simple truth, and it's one that has enormous consequences for politics. You talked about in your intro about, the refugees moving from various countries and the political consequences of that. We're going to see more and more of that. We're going to see more and more changes in disease patterns as animals carrying various microbes move into new places. You know, a simple example of this is mosquitoes. That are very sensitive to temperature, moving into hotter places, carrying diseases like dengue and Zika and malaria with them. We're seeing this in the, drying out of forests that are causing these bigger and hotter wildfires that are causing the smoke that is, inundated the East Coast in recent weeks. This changes in this sort of Goldilocks zone are profoundly rearranging life on our planet. And that's why heat is such an important force to understand, both in the way that it impacts our body, but also in the way it impacts the sort of dynamics of life on our planet.
Have you been shocked by how fast this has happened? And what do you think needs to happen?
I think anybody who's been watching this, talking about climate, journalists like myself and scientists who've been looking at this for a long time are both shocked by two things. One, by the how rapid the changes are that we're seeing given the kind of levels of CO2 that we're at, and also by the predictability of it in a certain way. I mean, you know, we've known, ExxonMobil has known for a very long time that as we burn fossil fuels and dump CO2 into the atmosphere, the temperature of the planet is going to rise. And it's broadly, you know, those predictions have held, been very accurate and held true, and we've known for decades. And the fact that we've done essentially nothing to stop that rise is, you know, terribly disappointing and predictable and surprising, you know, at the same time. And what do we need to do? We need to stop burning fossil fuels because that is what's driving the temperature change on the planet. And we also have to think differently about the risks that we are running. We have to understand something like heat. I think of my book as a sort of survival guide for the 21st century. We have to understand the risks of extreme heat and these extreme events, what to do, how to handle it, who's vulnerable, who's not, how to better address that, how to democratize air conditioning, how to build cities in a different way that incorporates shade, how to address events like extreme heat for the most vulnerable communities, cooling centers, things like that. We have not at all come close to grasping the scale and scope of the crisis we're facing. And that is not alarmist. That is just kind of the straightforward reality of where we are.
Jeff
and
Goodell,
I'm very hopeful.
We have 10 seconds.
I'm very hopeful that we can use this transformation to build a better and cleaner and more healthy world, but we need to really grasp what we're doing.
Jeff Goodell's new book is called The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Up next, I'm just back from Venice, Italy, where I spoke to Volker Turk, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and the former Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström about cluster bombs, Palestine, Sudan, and more. Back in 30 seconds. Naina kinaka legomadini ke nitantara rana hazwanzare forukaftanse kule nalefa nengano te sitalala italente kule setina ngefa vola nalefa no te tarengam baba simama. Children's Rights by Mika Healy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Towards a New Era for Human Rights. That was the name of a two-day conference held this weekend. On Friday night, it was held at the historic UNESCO building in Venice, Italy. The conference was organized by the Global Campus of Human Rights and Right Livelihood to mark the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This year also marks the 40th anniversary of the historic World Conference on Human Rights, which was held in Vienna in 1993. On Friday, I moderated a panel on the global state of human rights, looking at the recent U.S. decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine, looking at the war in Sudan, as well as Palestine, the role of civil society in elevating human rights issues, and the role of the media. Speakers on the panel included Volker Turk, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Eamon Gilmore, the European Union Special Representative for Human Rights, and the former Swedish Foreign Minister, Margot Wallström. She was also the former Deputy Prime Minister of Sweden, the former head of Sweden's Social Democratic Party, and the former UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict. While she was Foreign Minister in 2014, Sweden became the first member of the European Union to recognize the state of Palestine. I asked her about how Sweden made that decision.
That could not have come as a surprise. We had that. My party has fought for this for a very long time, has promised this in our sort of programs and all of that. So it was part of our sort of declaration when we took office as a new government. And then, of course, yeah, things could have been maybe phrased in a different way to give us a little bit more time if you look back at things that could have been done differently. But the main issue issue would not have come as a surprise to anybody. But the response was, of course, to make us an example, a bad example, so that they would scare anybody else from doing something similar, from other countries, from following our example. I know this for a fact, how this worked, for example, in the European Council. This was what happened all the time, that the Israelis used us as a scare, so to make sure that nobody else followed in the European Union. And it was a very, very tough decision. We made it clear that we had no interest in making sort of Israel our enemy. We wanted to continue to work with Israel for a two-state solution, which is the decision and the position of the European Union. But of course, this was extremely tough. And I think that, I have experienced this throughout my years as a foreign minister, that when you, if you're courageous, as I see it, if you take a position, if you follow, if you're consistent, you have to pay a price for it. That is absolutely, but without that, things would not move. We would not see an advance for human rights. So somebody must take a first step sometimes.
And related to this, and this could be to you or to any of the people on the panel, is the issue of cluster bombs, the use of cluster bombs. Something the United States said last year, a year ago, is what distinguished Putin from that. Was that he was willing to use cluster bombs, and the shock of so many when President Biden said that they will send cluster bombs to Ukraine. I mean, talking about everything from human rights to the destruction to the environment. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, this is very bad and very sad, and I really hope, one would hope that the Ukrainians would say that this is not sort of in our best interest either. But on the other hand, they ask for everything they can put their hands on right now because they want to win the war. But it is also very bad and very sad that the U.S. Thinks that this is the best help they can give to Ukraine, to send cluster bombs. I mean, I think there has to be a public opinion and there has to be a debate about this that takes it further. That's what I'm hoping for.
Would anyone else like to weigh in on that? Do you see this as a turning point where so many countries, more than 100 in the world, have signed on against the use of cluster bombs? And now one of those countries, the United States, who is signatory, along with Russia, along with Ukraine, none of them are, decide that they're going to move forward on this, what this means for the direction of the world at this point. Here.
Well, I'd be very plain on this. I don't think the United States should have made that decision. I don't think that cluster bombs should be used in Ukraine. I think we, as Margaret says, it is a sad reality that such huge amount of resources are being deployed to provide weaponry to Ukraine to enable them to prevail against this war of aggression. But I must say I was surprised, and I don't agree with the decision to provide cluster bombs to Ukraine.
That was Eamon Gilmore, European Union Special Rep for Human Rights. This is Volker Turk.
For Human Rights, and I was actually asked.
This is Volman Turk, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
I just want to say something about this because you asked. I was actually asked the question at the Human Rights Council 2 days ago during an interactive dialogue on Ukraine, and our position is very clear. I mean, cluster bombs should be prohibited. They have an indiscriminate effect on civilian populations. Both Russia, Ukraine, U.S. hasn't signed the treaty, which is unfortunate, but that doesn't mean, Okay, does this work? No, what I just mentioned, at the Human Rights Council, we had an interactive dialogue on Ukraine 2 days ago, and I got that question. What is the position of the UN in relation to cluster ammunition and the use of cluster bombs? And it's obvious that it has an indiscriminate effect on civilians. Unfortunately, the bomblets will stay for probably generations to come, so people will live with it. It is true that Russia, Ukraine, and the US have not signed the treaty, but that doesn't mean under human rights law that we couldn't argue against it, and it's clear. Because any indiscriminate effect that ammunition has on civilians should not be used.
Have you spoken to the U.S. government about this, President Biden?
I don't speak to President Biden, but we have made it very clear publicly, the Secretary General as well, not just us as from the human rights side.
How do you see this war ending?
I mean, I think it is important to think about the day after. And I was in Ukraine in December, beginning of December. And, you know, I met a lot of civil society actors, human rights defenders, victims. And one thing that became very clear that the whole civil society is involved no longer in the typical work that you do on the human rights front, but they're all involved in the humanitarian response. So you see a shift away from the work that they did before, focusing on vulnerable people, people with disabilities, older people, horrible institutionalized care arrangements for children, the corruption issues, the lack of independence of the judiciary, and all of those issues. They can't focus on it now because of their national survival. But I think it is very important that everyone who supports Ukraine has to support Ukraine of the future, which means all of the type of issues, rule of law, independent judiciary, support for the prosecutor general, but in line with international standards. And that's going to be a big, big... So reconstruction cannot just be a logistical exercise. It also has to be an exercise of... It has to be guided, inspired by human rights.
Are you hopeful?
Hope springs eternal. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do our work.
I was just, you just heard me talking to the former foreign minister of Sweden about Palestine and the position Sweden took early on. You also just took a position demanding that Israel take its occupation that it has legal obligations as an occupying force in Palestine. Can you comment on that as the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights?
Well, obviously, it's a very complex situation. My first speech to the Council in March, when there was a specific discussion on it, highlighted the fact that, you know, my office on the ground issues a report every couple of months on the situation, describing what is happening. We make recommendations again and again and again to both sides, by the way, and that's also important. And we miss a serious effort to look at these recommendations and to implement them. And that's really a problem. And we need to find ways and means that both parties are able to have back channels, talk to each other, find ways to de-escalate. But what we see is an escalation. We are in this, I call it the illogic of escalation, because it's not a logic. It's an illogic of escalation. So whoever has any influence needs to find ways and means to de-escalate, and find a way to they think again also about their future.
I mean, Israel is the occupying force. Palestine, though Israel isn't a signatory to the International Criminal Court, Palestine is. Do you think Israel should be brought before that court?
Of course, accountability is important. It starts at home. So if war crimes are committed, they need to be investigated. That's also one of the recommendations that we consistently make to the Israelis, but also to the other side. They need to investigate. Sometimes it happens, but it doesn't happen with the seriousness that is required.
Let me just ask you, because you just came in. You
Sorry
just
for that.
Faced a very...
Travel in Europe.
No, but I didn't mean you just that you were late. I meant that because you just came in, this is such an opportunity. But what's happening right now in Sudan, you just made a major statement about, and this mass grave that was discovered in Darfur. Can you talk about that?
Well, Sudan was the first country that I visited after I took office within 3 weeks. And I met both Burhan and Hemeti, both the two warring men, because they are men, they are warring parties, and we concentrate always on them, right? We talk about these two men that are waging a war against each other. Totally irresponsible. I had a lot of hope. I was so inspired by what I saw from the Sudanese population that I met. I mean, I met so many human rights defenders, the victims, I mean, young people, these resistance committees that were established. In fact, it's incredible that despite the fact that there was a second coup in October 21, for a year, with brute force, young people, women, and the population, in particular in Khartoum, resisted the onslaught of repression from the military. Because I think they have had enough of what happened during Bashir, al-Bashir's time. And they just wanted to get rid of it, right? And then you have these two men, when we were so close towards a civilian transition, to blow up the country. It has a lot to do with geopolitics, I have to say, because in the past, certain things probably would have been much more difficult to achieve. I mean, there would be more control over certain things. Now it's a free-for-all.
What
and
do you
they
mean
benefit.
By geopolitics?
Look, we have US, China, West, Russia, West, Global South. So it's chaotic. The Security Council. I mean, when we had a special session on Sudan in the Human Rights Council, there was a group of states that said we shouldn't discuss Sudan in the Human Rights Council. Because we shouldn't discuss country mandates. Well, if there is a situation to be discussed, it's obviously any new situation that emerges. So it was really quite remarkable how we don't come back to the basic consensus that the world had in the wake of the Second World War, after the cataclysmic events, with the adoption of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we need to be striving and going back to the past in order to be able to deal with the future. And so, yes, when it comes to Sudan, a big issue was accountability and transitional justice that wasn't coming in quickly enough. You saw Karim Khan, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, gave a speech to the Security Council yesterday, and he will start investigations.
And what was found, the mass grave in Darfur?
So we had interviewed people, because we are no longer present in Darfur, because it's impossible. But we have teams in Chad who interviewed refugees who came over, and that we could, as a result, identify and do our typical methodological thing to identify what had actually happened. And yes, it was, I mean, the RSF and the militias and the Masalit are campaigning for, there's ethnic cleansing taking place as we speak.
In all of the meetings that have been taking place in Egypt and Saudi Arabia around this, one of the issues that civil society keeps raising are, where are they at the table? And they feel that we wouldn't even be at this point with Sudan if they were included. And then if you could comment on that, and then as we begin to wrap up this panel, for everyone, the role both of civil society, how important that is, even in you doing your job, what becomes acceptable to say and what isn't, and the role of the media.
No, I mean, Margot, when you were in the position of special representative on sexual violence and conflict, I mean, one of the big achievements of the Security Council was women, peace, and security. You know, this decision that when it comes to peace processes, there needs to be a conscious effort to bring women onto the negotiating table, to include them, to so that they are part of it. Every year we do an analysis of how many of the peace negotiations, I mean, I don't know if you remember, very early on when the Russians, Ukrainians sat down beginning of March, did you remember the picture on both sides? Only men. In both negotiating teams, it was only men. And I think it is so important because each and every conflict, when we emerge from it, when there is peace negotiated, it's always the warring factions that discuss it. It's not the whole of civil society. I mean, South Sudan is another example. So we have all these different issues where there wasn't an inclusive participatory effort to bring everyone around the table to discuss these things. It was always left to those who waged the war. And we really need to fight back on this. That's absolutely critical. And you know, Sudan is a good example. It was led by young people. It was led by women, very courageous women. It was led by those who just had enough of it.
Yeah, where are they now when it comes to the formal negotiations?
Well, there are no formal negotiations. I mean, to be honest, not very serious ones at the moment. I don't think these two guys are serious about it. They think that they can win on the battlefield and they will bring the country to the brink. Well, it's already close to the brink, so I don't know how deeper it can go. Huh?
And the role of the media?
Well, of course, if you look, I'll just give you one example. If you look it is so crucial that we have independent, serious media that report on these situations and that they bring them to the table of everywhere in the world. If I look at even mainstream media today, I'm very disappointed. I mean, just to give, and I know it's a sensitive thing to raise, but just look at what happened. We had within a week the sinking of the boat in Greece, and then the submarine with the Titanic. Just watch how much attention was paid to the submarine. I think it was almost minute by minute. And the probably 800 people that died horribly, it was maybe a day, maybe another news sometime else. And if that had happened, if it had been a plane, if it had been, this would be what, four planes crashing? Can you imagine what this would have meant? So there is an interesting dimension to how media report about what I think is very selective.
At Democracy Now, we called it the Titanic disparity.
That's how you called it?
Yes.
Exactly. I'm glad you think about that, yes.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up, and this has been a fascinating discussion. Are there any final words you'd like to offer?
Well, we will have a continuation of our discussions tomorrow, but I think one thing that for me is so important that we, and I sometimes feel it with politicians these days, they forget about history or they don't really want to know much about history. I don't know whether, Margaret, it was also your experience, especially some of the younger generations. History is sort of put somewhere else. Sometimes it's not even known. And we really need to know about it. And we need to know what the genesis is of the type of achievements that we have had also on the human rights side. And we should be so grateful for what the human rights movement has achieved over the last 100 years. It goes actually even in the 19th century with the labor movement. I mean, you have so many different movements, decolonization. I mean, you have all these movements. Well, it starts with some of the revolutions. And that actually gives me a lot of hope that the big issues of our time and of the future, we are able to do it again through the human rights lens, because it brings us back to what unites us. It brings us back to what is a solution. It's not just the doom and gloom. It is a solution to problems. And we just need to find, well, new era, right? We have to think about human rights for the new era, but it is human rights.
That's Volker Türk, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Eamon Gilmore, the European Union Special Representative for Human Rights, and Margot Wallström, the former Swedish foreign minister. She was also the former deputy prime minister of Sweden and the former head of Sweden's Social Democratic Party, as well as the former UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict. They were speaking this weekend at a conference I moderated in Venice, Italy, talking about a new era for human rights, the conference organized by the Global Campus of Human Rights and Right Livelihood to mark the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. As the conference ended, thousands of Venetians went out in boats. We joined them to celebrate the city's oldest holiday, marking the end of the 16th century plague, the pestilence that killed a third of Venice's population. There was a half-hour fireworks display as people celebrated. I'm Amy Goodman, back in New York. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, civil rights attorney Michael Avery discusses the role the Federalist Society played in the Supreme Court's recent decision gutting affirmative action.
The Supreme Court struck down race-based affirmative action programs in colleges and universities.
And our own Marjorie Cohn discusses the Supreme Court's recent case, Moore versus Harper, that shut down a fringe legal theory on voting rights.
The Supreme Court maintained the status quo in the face of Republican attacks on the right to vote.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. On June 28th, the Supreme Court made front page national headlines for overturning legal precedent supporting race-based affirmative action programs in colleges and universities. The decision rejected race-conscious admissions at Harvard College and the University of North Carolina, or UNC. The court's conservative supermajority found in favor of Students for Fair Admissions, a nonprofit founded in 2014 that sued Harvard and UNC over their admissions procedures. The group, headed by conservative activist Edward Blum, alleged that the process violates Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by discriminating against Asian American applicants in favor of white applicants. Paving the way for overturning 40 years of precedent was one group that we've covered for years on Law and Disorder, the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. This conservative, libertarian organization advocates for a textualist and originalist interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. Over several decades, until recently working under the radar, it has dramatically altered the legal landscape in this country. Joining us today is civil rights attorney Michael Avery, co-author with Danielle McLaughlin of the 2013 book, The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals, and a recent article in Truthout, co-authored with Professor Mark Broden, about how the Federalist Society killed affirmative action. Professor Emeritus at Suffolk University Law School, Michael Avery was president of the National Lawyers Guild and served as president of the board of the National Police Accountability Project. Michael Avery, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Michael, what were the three main rationales that Chief Justice John Roberts outlined in his decision for the Supreme Court on affirmative action?
First of all, Roberts found that the goals